The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Now to other matters, less or more important, I suppose, depending on where you stand. Quentin Tarantino, I suppose, really, he is one of the iconic film directors of the past few decades. And he confirmed recently something that he had always said, in fairness, he had a plan and that he would make 10 movies and then retire, because he says from here on in, filmmakers don't get better. Here he is on being taken to task by Bill Maher about his decision to retire.
To me, this is your latest one is your peak. This is my favorite of all time. So what is this nonsense about you're only going to make one more movie? You're too young to quit, and you're at the top of your game. Why?
That's why I want to quit.
How do you know it's the top?
Because I know film history, and from here on in, directors do not get better.
Okay, so there's Quentin Tarantino confirming that one more film, so his next film will be his last. And some people might think that's no bad thing. I'm joined now by Dr. Harvey O'Brien of the School of English Drama and Film at UCD and film producer Rebecca O'Flanagan of Treasure Entertainments. Good afternoon, guys.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
So, Harvey, maybe to start, maybe to put this in context, what's so great about Tarantino?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting question, because I was contemplating that when we were thinking about this item. And there was a time when I started teaching, which was in the 1990s. And you said the word Tarantino and everybody went quiet, because he was the coolest filmmaker around. He seemed to be bringing new energy to genre films. He was young. He was part of an independent new American cinema. And everybody was very excited. Now you mention Tarantino and it's kind of, oh, yeah, he's less sort of center of the culture. But I think that in the body of work that he has made over time, we do have talking points for every film. There are things that he has done in the course of his career that I think are worth continuing to talk about. So that makes him important.
Okay. Rebecca, what would be your assessment? I mean, I can see what Harvey's saying there, that like when he emerged in the 90s and when we first saw like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, it did feel a little bit like, whoa, this changes everything, didn't it?
Yeah, they were massive disruptors as movies. It shook the film industry, and there was a sense of there was really vibrant new voice on the scene. And there was something that he was able to do that his films, those early films, there was something achingly cool about them. He seemed to just have his finger right on the pulse all the time. And as Harvey says, they were absolutely there with the talking point, and it felt like it was part of a new wave. But I would suggest, you know, if you're now in your late 50s and you're still kind of playing off a lot of the same tricks yes. that you had in your box then,
yeah, okay.
and you're still playing the enfant terrible at this stage at your late 50s, maybe it is time to rebrand.
Okay, but Harvey, just before we get on to his more problematic later periods or his lesser later period, just to reflect a little bit, like there was that sense, wasn't there, that we were almost back to the days of, you know, that Easy Riders and Raging Bulls book, that there was a sense that that film was kind of cool again, wasn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the era in the early 90s was the kind of reemergence of American independent cinema. You know, you had Spike Lee and you had Mike Slackers and Dykes was the book that was out at the time, talking about the energy that was there. Because what you were dealing with was the old studio system, which had been reinvigorated in the 80s with all of these commercial successes, then finding these new voices with slightly lower budgets and slightly riskier projects. And out of it came a new sensibility and a new energy. And what Tarantino was bringing to that was a sense of the history that had gone before, which was actually his USP, if you want to put it that way, the thing that he brought to it. Because, say, where Spike Lee was bringing a new voice coming from his community and things like that, Tarantino was literally bouncing off the history of American cinema. Yeah. And as we approached the centenary of cinema, and that's the thing we have to remember, Reservoir Dogs was 1992. The centenary of cinema was, you know, 1995. So up to that point, we hadn't even had 100 years of cinema. And he was reminding us of that 100 years and now seemingly pushing it into something new.
Yeah, and kind of almost meta and almost chopping it up and putting it back together again. Though I always thought that, like, and kind of like Scorsese in this reflect, in this respect, that Tarantino didn't make movies as such. He made bunches of really cool scenes and kind of put them together into movies, and they're very quotable and all that. Let's just take a little example of one of them. This is from Pulp Fiction, and this is probably the most famous piece of dialogue from Pulp Fiction. It's the scene where John Travolta is telling Samuel L. Jackson about the cultural differences between the US and Europe.
But you know what the funniest thing about Europe is?
What?
It's the little differences.
Example.
All right, well, you can walk into a movie theater in Amsterdam and buy a beer. And I don't mean just like an old paper cup. I'm talking about a glass of beer. And in Paris, you can buy a beer in McDonald's. And you know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese?
No, man, they got the metric system.
And what do they call it?
They call it Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
That's right.
What do they call a Big Mac?
Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac. What do they call a Whopper?
I don't know. I didn't go on a Burger King.
See, Rebecca, when I listen to that note, I'm almost slightly embarrassed, because I'd say there are kids listening to that thinking, you got excited over this, like these two guys having a mundane conversation. Do they stand the test of time for you, the earlier movies?
Well, I mean, I think something like Pulp Fiction is really interesting because, I mean, it kind of told us in the title that that's what this was. It was something that was kind of unapologetically amoral in a way, and I think he's, you know, I think that was kind of owned by him, but it was you know, deliberately a lot of it was style over substance, but boy, the style was something, you know. It was absolutely edge of your seat stuff, and it felt so fresh, and you know, and even as you mentioned there, John Travolta, it was like to have the audacity to take somebody like him, who was at the time was considered washed up and uncool, and to kind of put him in a part that made him right back at the center of coolness was something, I think, that really was just showed such a confidence in his storytelling.
He was really good at that always, though, wasn't he? Kind of retooling and recontextualizing, reinventing actors.
I think he was a, you know, in terms of just the branding of both himself and his films, I think, you know, he was masterful at that. You know, I think even just the narrative of him, that he was the movie store geek and he just spent all his life watching movies, and then when he came to the point of actually having the opportunity to tell them, that he knew exactly and precisely what he wanted to do. And as you say, he always kind of owned the fact that he took so much from the movies that he loved and that had influenced him. So that was something he did with such kind of bravado. But it just seemed to me that there came a point where, unless you can kind of evolve and mature from that point. But I mean, Pulp Fiction for me is the one that does kind of stand up. It has so many of those quotable lines. And, you know, I think actually, you know, each of those individual storylines do have their own kind of structure and pace that does amount to something.
And Harvey, on what Rebecca says there about his ability to mature, the maturing and the substance, it was kind of stop start a bit, like you would think he seemed to have kind of moved on and grown, and then you would think, well, maybe not so much. But you think, for example, that Jackie Brown does get overlooked, and that's a more substantial movie.
Yeah, I mean, Jackie Brown is still, when you look at it today, a film that has a very extraordinary center to it, which is age. Now, they weren't very old, but Robert Forster was 56 and Pam Grier was in her late 40s. And, you know, for a female actor of that generation to kind of have been forgotten and come back at 40 in her late 40s was kind of, it gave it a very different rhythm. These were not cool young people. These were adults, and they were having adult conversations very often about age and about how to kind of get out of a world that is driven by people who are young and energetic and cool, like the young cop played by Michael Keaton, or the drug dealer by Samuel Jackson, and they're contrasted with the Robert De Niro character, who's seen as old and broken down. So you still don't get films that kind of give a decent voice to people who are not young and cool. And Jackie Brown was a very patient film in a way that, you know, Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs had not been. And it still holds up, I think.
Yeah, Rebecca.
And is it possible that perhaps, you know, because that was an adaptation and it was something that he, you know, had that kind of very solid storyline behind it, or, you know, had the source material behind it, that in the way some of his other films, it felt to me just became flights of fancy and didn't have that anchoring of perhaps the fact that it was adapted from a book.
Okay.
Yeah, now, that's quite possibly true.
So, in terms of the style over substance, one thing he was amazing at, we say he retooled and recontextualized actors, but music was central to all of this as well. And I suppose, like, if you were to think of, I don't know, certainly when I was growing up, the Reservoir Dogs soundtrack, along with, funnily enough, the Trainspotting soundtrack, I think they reinvented soundtracks. Rebecca, he used music really, really well, didn't he?
Amazingly well. And again, he, as you say, he did the same as he had done with actors. He took tunes that were somewhere and he just reinvented them. He represented them to us in a way that all of a sudden, I think, like you say, Reservoir Dogs, but also I would certainly remember Pulp Fiction was one that everybody had. And all of those songs just became, you know, part of the culture again.
Yeah, yeah. And look, what we might do is we might play, we have a montage of some of the music there, but I might keep it for the end. Now, moving on through the other films, there are a lot of people would say that the Kill Bill, the two Kill Bill movies are kind of his masterpiece in a way. And like, it's funny, isn't it, Harvey, that like they're kind of genre movies that should be trashy in a way, but he kind of turns it into almost opera or something.
He does do that. He does elevate it through style, but I would argue it's still trash, but trash in the kind of positive sense of it. It's you know, to use these horrible academic terms, it is postmodern. It is like a bricolage. He's pulling together all of this stuff and then by staging it superbly. I mean, he's a brilliant articulator of space and of characters within space and of how to visualize what that person might do in that space in a way that is, you know, electrifying in genre terms. He takes material that is still Pulp Fiction, as Rebecca said, and takes it to that level. So Kill Bill, you know, Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained, I mean, these are revisiting kind of master Hollywood genres. And to me, you know, I don't dislike some of those films, but I do think that there's an element of, even compared to Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, that he's kind of squandering a really brilliant cinematic sense on material that is self-consciously trashy to a greater degree, I think, than some of his earlier.
Okay.
To me, after Jackie Brown, that was a come down.
So his mother would have said to him, "You're squandering your talent there, young man, on these things." Let's take
that's
a little
the teacher coming out of me.
Let's take a little clip of Kill Bill first. I want to come back to Inglourious Basterds in a second. So here's this is the climax of the two Kill Bill movies, and it's the face off between the bride, who was Uma Thurman, and the man who left her for dead, and that's Bill, the Bill of the title, played by David Carradine.
I'm a killer. I'm a murdering bastard, you know that? And there are consequences to breaking the heart of a murdering bastard. You experience some of them. Was my reaction really that surprising?
Yes, it was. Could you do what you did? Of course you could. But I never thought you would or could do that to me.
I'm really sorry, kiddo, but you thought wrong.
You and I have unfinished business.
Baby, you ain't kidding.
Harvey, like, it might be trash, but he spun that into poetry.
Oh, hey, listen, I mean, I'm not putting bad connotations on the word trash.
There a thing, what Harvey's saying there about squandering his talent, for me, what happened then with each of these subsequent films, where they were amazing set pieces, and like Harvey says, I don't think anybody can, you know, on you know, that kind of technical and creative, the style side of it, I don't think anybody can question it. But it felt like every film to me, as built up, was, is there any substance? And does this guy have anything to say beyond just, you know, showing us his
cool
flair as a filmmaker?
Yeah.
Ain't it like, cool? I mean, you know, Ain't It Cool News, that kind of era of the internet. I mean, it kind of fed into that. And that was a Travolta line from a John Woo film, but coolness, you know. And at some point, that does become a little bit
tiresome.
And then, right? Yep. I remember the first time I saw the opening scene of Inglourious Basterds, and I thought that this is possibly going to be the best film I'll ever see. That extraordinary long opening scene where tension is building and everything. And then the rest of it, Harvey, like.
Yeah. That to me was the real, that is that paradigm. I thought that opening of that film was stunning, and I was so engrossed, and I was thinking, my God, Tarantino is going to really kind of give this material to us in a new way, and in a way that's terrifying and engaging, and it was brilliant. And then in the end, he gave us garbage. I mean, you know, the last sequence is pure, utter indulgence, the blowing up of the cinema and all that. And then this kind of statement to the audience, this might be my masterpiece. To me, that was like, oh, he's completely blown it. That's where that squandering thing comes from me. Because he really had in his hands the material to make a very powerful war film, and he wound up just making, well, trash.
Yeah. Let's just enjoy a bit of that, the start of Inglourious Basterds. Here's Christopher Waltz as the SS officer, and he's, I suppose you could say, attending to his paperwork.
Are you aware of my existence?
Yes.
This is good. Are you aware of the job I've been ordered to carry out in France?
Yes.
Please tell me what you've heard.
I've heard that the Führer has put you in charge of rounding up the Jews left in France while the Heiling are passing for Gentile.
The Führer couldn't have said it better himself.
But the meaning of your visit, pleasant though it is mysterious to me. The Germans looked through my house 9 months ago for hiding Jews and found nothing.
I'm aware of that. I read the reports on this area. But like any enterprise, when under new management, there's always a slight duplication of efforts. Most of it being a complete waste of time, but needs to be done nevertheless.
Beautiful. Okay. Harvey and Rebecca, would you stay with me a minute? Because I'm conscious that there's another aspect to this that I think we probably should talk about. And that's the slight, possibly problematic nature of Tarantino as time went on. But I need to take a quick break, okay?
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Dr. Harvey O'Brien and film producer Rebecca O'Flanagan are still with us, and we are conducting the funeral of Quentin Tarantino's movie career here. I hope Quentin's not listening, because he'll give up after 9. Someone here, a texter here, guys, says Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is an absolute masterpiece. The pace and flow, it makes me feel like I'm in my third beer on a hot summer's evening every time I watch it. Incredible performances, drunk DiCaprio shouting at hippies is something to behold. Every time you watch a texter, I didn't make it through it once. I'm going to admit here now, I stopped watching it. Is anyone going to make an argument for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood being any good?
I like this. I actually like this. Let me put my hand up on that one. I actually thought, you know, contrary to what has been a fairly negative kind of take on him, I actually thought that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood had something going on in it. And what I thought was going on in it was, again, a little bit like Jackie Brown. There was a line of maturity, but you have to look and see kind of where it's drawn.
Oh, yeah, and you have to wait and wait and wait, Harvey.
It's about... Yeah, the irony is it's about inconsequence, and it's about kind of the unimportant life is ultimately the important life.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting theme. And it takes a while before you really get it in the film, but it comes through. And I think that I have rewatched it. And again, like every Tarantino film, every individual sequence is beautifully done. But I do think that it arrived at a point at the end where it kind of earned an ending that seemed, in a sense, ridiculous to counterpoint history, as he did in Inglourious Basterds and so forth. Okay. But in this time, I was with him on it. I actually thought it was pretty good.
Okay, Rebecca?
I wouldn't agree. I thought again it was his most undisciplined. I found it just actually meandering and boring in places. And I thought it was massively cynical to take something like, you know, the tragedy that had happened there, both the tragedy of those young girls who were kind of disenfranchised women who have been exploited by Manson, and Sharon Tate herself, who, you know, I think was just objectified and occupied the film, except for the one sequence where she goes to the cinema and watches herself, but she was kind of an ornament in the film. And I think then it was, to me, it just seemed like an adolescent fantasy to go, but if I was there, ha ha ha, look at all the ways I would have absolutely brutally murdered those people. And I thought the violence was just...
Okay.
You know, really unpalatable.
Okay, so there's two strands to what you're saying there. The first one, it's interesting that you say boring, because wasn't that Tarantino's unspoken contract with cinema goers was, I'll never bore you, like, you know, love me, yeah, hate me, I won't bore you. And I think it was, the big crime was, it was boring. The second part probably deserves broader discussion. So I think there is an increasing, due to various things, Rebecca, is there an increasing kind of view that Tarantino is a little bit, as we say, you know, problematic?
Yeah, I think there probably is. And, you know, it's hard to kind of completely distance, you know, the films that, you know, it, to look at those objectively and not also revisit them in terms of what we know was the culture and the climate and his association with Harvey Weinstein. And, you know, it's something like the Kill Bill films. But, you know, when you also now have Uma Thurman coming out of how he, you know, spat in her face in order to get certain scenes, that you're just going, okay, it's hard to take these, yeah, and enjoy them as a revenge fantasy.
Yeah, when you the know Uma Thurman thing is, I can't quite get my head around it, because she did play along for years with this notion. He kind of had this thing, she was a muse of his, but he also, yeah, had this thing of kind of being semi in love with her. She seemed, yeah, to play along with it for years, but now it emerges that she felt unsafe some of the time, and that the whole thing sounds a bit more creepy, really.
Well, it does. And I think the fact that that she played along with it, I think we've seen that there was a huge amount of these women who did, and that they played the part of muse because that was the culture of the industry, you know, and that she was harassed throughout those films by Harvey Weinstein as well. And, you know, we didn't have that culture of just going, no, absolutely no way are you spitting in my face. I am not, that is not, that is not what I'm here for. And, yeah, and I, so I think the fact that, you know, I don't think she would deny that that was discussed and she did agree to it. But, you know, that I don't think that diminishes the fact that when you look back on that, you just think how anybody could feel that that is a justifiable thing to do for the sake of their art just really is reflective of this absolutely toxic culture that was prevalent at the time.
So Harvey, like, does Quentin Tarantino fit in the new world and the new world of cinema as well? Like, is he pale, male and stale and, you know,
well, that's it. Time's you up see, for that's- him? That's the interesting question, because like I said, in a sense, his emergence in the 1990s is part of, you know, what I would see as that moment in the turning point in the history of cinema after the 100-year anniversary. Now becomes that he also belongs to the before Me Too era, in which the working methods of Hollywood were, as we know, hugely exploitative behind the scenes in a way that perhaps we weren't even aware, even though we might have been vaguely aware that it was always like that in Hollywood. And so that makes it now, especially because, I mean, his name is associated with a man who is a convicted criminal, that means it's a little more complicated for us to understand it. But to me, that is also, of course, part of the challenge of history, that we do have to understand it, that that is where it belongs. So the question is, does Tarantino then belong in the past? I mean, he has said in relation to the whole Weinstein thing himself, he knew enough to do more than he did do about it, which makes him a beneficiary of the toxic culture and it makes him partially culpable in it. But does that mean that he should therefore never work again? Or does it mean that he needs to sort of figure out where his place is in the new world, the post-Me Too world.
So look, we'll be interested to see what his swan song is then. Dr. Harvey O'Brien of the School of English Drama and Film at UCD and film producer Rebecca O'Flanagan of Treasure Entertainment, thank you very much for that. And you know what? We'll finish up. We talked about his great use of music. Let's finish up with this little montage of some songs from various Tarantino films.
Everything is all right. You kiss and tell me everything is all right. Can I get away again tonight?
You don't know you want this time. Give me up. Oh. Give me up.
Show you never can tell.
shot me down, bang, bang. I hit the ground, bang, bang. That awful sound, bang, bang. My baby shot me down.
Email brendan@rte.ie.